old self. He's tossing money around. Treats me to espresso and croissant at a little bakery with stools by a window, then tries to buy me books at the Edgartown bookshop. When I refuse the gift, he shakes his head at my giveaway project but doesn't lecture. Instead, he asks for my help picking out presents for the littles and a floral design book for Ginny, the housekeeper. We place a big order at Murdoch's Fudge. Chocolate, chocolate walnut, peanut butter, and panuche. Browsing in one of the art galleries, we run into Granddad's lawyer, a narrow, graying fellow named Richard Thatcher. "So this is Cadence the First," says Thatcher, shaking my hand. "I've heard a great deal about you." "He does the estate," says Granddad by way of explanation. "First grandchild," says Thatcher. "There's never anything to match that feeling." "She's got a great head on her shoulders, too," Granddad says. "Sinclair blood through and through." This speaking in stock phrases, he has always done it. Never complain, never explain, don't take no for an answer. But it grates when he's using them about me. A good head on my shoulders? My actual head is fucking broken in countless medically diagnosed ways, and half of me comes from the unfaithful Eastman side of the family. I am not going to college next year. I've given up all the sports I used to do and clubs I used to be part of. I'm high on Percocet half the time, and I'm not even nice to my little cousins. Still, Granddad's face is glowing as he talks about me. And at least today he knows I am not Mirren.
"She looks like you," says Thatcher. "Doesn't she? Except she's good-looking."
"Thank you," I say. "But if you want the full resemblance, I have to tuft up my hair." This makes Granddad smile.
"It's from the boat," he says to Thatcher. "Didn't bring a hat."
"It's always tufty," I tell Thatcher.
"I know," he says.
The men shake hands and Granddad hooks his arm through mine as we leave the gallery.
"He's taken good care of you," he tells me.
"Mr. Thatcher?" He nods.
"But don't tell your mother. She'll stir up trouble again."
Chapter 42. On the way home, a memory comes. Summer 15, a morning in early July. Granddad was making espresso in the Claremont kitchen. I was eating jam and baguette toast at the table. It was just the two of us. "I love that goose," I said, pointing. A cream goose statue sat on the sideboard.
"It's been there since you, Johnny, and Mirren were three," said Granddad. "That's the year Tipper and I took that trip to China," he chuckled. "She bought a lot of art there. We had a guide, an art specialist."
He came over to the toaster and popped the piece of bread I had in there for myself. "Hey," I objected.
"Shush, I'm the Granddad. I can take the toast when I want to."
He sat down with his espresso and spread butter on the baguette.
"This art specialist girl took us to antique shops and helped us navigate the auction houses," he said. "She spoke four languages. You wouldn't think to look at her, little slip of a China girl."
"Don't say China girl. Hello." He ignored me.
"Tipper bought jewelry and had the idea of buying animal sculptures for the houses here."
"Does that include the toad and Cuddledown?"
"Sure, the ivory toad," said Granddad. "And we bought two elephants, I know."
"Those are in Windermere."
"And monkeys in Redgate. There were four monkeys."
"Isn't ivory illegal?" I asked.
"Oh, some places, but you can get it. Your gran loved ivory. She traveled to China when she was a child."
"Is it elephant tusks?"
"That, or rhino."
There he was, Granddad. His white hair still thick, the lines on his face deep from all those days on the sailboat, his heavy jaw like an old film star. "You can get it," he said, about the ivory. One of his mottos, don't take no for an answer. It had always seemed a heroic way to live. He would say it when advising us to pursue our ambitions, when encouraging Johnny to try training for a marathon, or when I failed to win the reading prize in 7th grade. It was something he said when talking about his business strategies and how he got Gran to marry him.
"I asked her 4 times before she said yes," he'd always say, retelling one of his favorite Sinclair family legends. "I wore her down. She said yes to shut me up."
Now, at the breakfast table, watching him eat my toast, don't take no for an answer seemed like the attitude of a privileged guy who didn't care who got hurt, so long as his wife had the cute statues she wanted to display in her summer houses. I walked over and picked up the goose. "People shouldn't buy ivory," I said. "It's illegal for a reason. Gat was reading the other day about..."
"Don't tell me what that boy is reading," snapped Granddad. "I'm informed. I get all the papers."
"Sorry, but he's made me think about..."
"Cadence.
You could put the statues up for auction and then donate the money to wildlife conservation."
"Then I wouldn't have the statues. They were very dear to Tipper."
"But..." Granddad barked.
"Do not tell me what to do with my money, Katie. That money is not yours."
"Okay."
"You are not to tell me how to dispose of what is mine. Is that clear?"
"Yes."
"Not ever."
"Yes, Granddad." I had the urge to snatch the goose and fling it across the room. Would it break when it hit the fireplace? Would it shatter? I balled my hands into fists. It was the first time we'd talked about Granny Tipper since her death. Granddad docks the boat and ties it up. "Do you still miss Gran?" I ask him as we head toward New Claremont. "Because I miss her. We never talk about her."
"A part of me died," he says. "And it was the best part."
"You think so?" I ask.
"That is all there is to say about it," says Granddad.
Chapter 43. I find the Liars in the cuddle-down yard. The grass is littered with tennis rackets and drink bottles, food wrappers and beach towels. The three of them lie on cotton blankets, wearing sunglasses and eating potato chips. "Feeling better?" asks Mirren. I nod. "We missed you." They have baby oil spread on their bodies. 2 bottles of it lie on the grass. "Aren't you afraid you'll get burned?" I ask.
"I don't believe in sunblock anymore," says Johnny.
He's decided the scientists are corrupt, and the whole sunblock industry is a money-making fraud, says Mirren. "Have you ever seen sun poisoning?" I ask. "The skin literally bubbles." "It's a dumb idea," says Mirren. "We're just bored out of our minds, that's all." But she slathers baby oil on her arms as she's speaking. I lie down next to Johnny. I open a bag of barbecue potato chips. I stare at Gat's chest. Mirren reads aloud a bit of a book about Jane Goodall. We listen to some music off my iPhone, the speaker tinny. "Why don't you believe in sunblock again?" I ask Johnny.
"It's a conspiracy," he says, "to sell a lot of lotion that nobody needs."
"Uh-huh."
"I won't burn," he says. "You'll see."
"But why are you putting on baby oil?"
"Oh, that's not part of the experiment," Johnny says. "I just like to be as greasy as possible at all times."
Gat catches me in the kitchen looking for food. There isn't much.
Last time I saw you was, again, suboptimal, he says. In the hallway. A couple of nights ago.
Yeah. My hands are shaking.
Sorry.
All right.
Can we start over?
We can't start over every day, Gat.
Why not?
He jumps to sit on the counter.
Maybe this is a summer of second chances.
Second, sure, but after that it gets ridiculous.
So, just be normal, he says, at least for today. Let's pretend I'm not a mess. Let's pretend you're not angry. Let's act like we're friends and forget what happened.
I don't want to pretend. I don't want to be friends. I don't want to forget. I am trying to remember.
Just for a day or two until things start to seem all right again, says Gat, seeing my hesitation. We'll just hang out until it all stops being such a big deal.
I want to know everything, understand everything. I want to hold Gat close and run my hands over him and never let him go. But perhaps this is the only way we can start. Be normal now, right now, because you are, because you can be. I've learned how to do that, I say. I hand him the bag of fudge Grandad and I bought in Edgartown, and the way his face lights up at the chocolate tugs at my heart. Chapter 44. Next day, Mirren and I take the small motorboat to Edgartown without permission. The boys don't want to come. They are going kayaking. I drive, and Mirren trails her hand in the wake. Mirren isn't wearing much, a daisy print bikini top and a denim miniskirt. She walks down the cobblestone sidewalks of Edgartown talking about Drake Loggerhead and how it feels to have sexual intercourse with him. That's what she calls it every time. Her answer about how it feels has to do with the scent of beach roses mixed with roller coasters and fireworks. She also talks about what clothes she wants to buy for freshman year at Pomona, and movies she wants to see and projects she wants to do this summer, like find a place on the vineyard to ride horses and start making ice cream again. Honestly, she doesn't stop chattering for half an hour. I wish I had her life. A boyfriend, plans, college in California. Mirren is going off into her sunshine future, whereas I am going back to Dickinson Academy to another year of snow and suffocation. I buy a small bag of fudge at Murdoch's, even though there's some left from yesterday. We sit on a shady bench, Mirren still talking. Another memory comes. Summer 15, Mirren sat next to Taft and Will on the steps of our favorite Edgartown clam shack. The boys had plastic rainbow pinwheels. Taft's face was smeared with fudge he'd eaten earlier. We were waiting for Bess because she had Mirren's shoes. We couldn't go indoors without them. Mirren's feet were dirty and her toenails painted blue. We had been waiting a while when Gat came out of the shop down the block. He had a stack of books under his arm. He ran toward us at top speed, as if in a ridiculous hurry to catch us, even though we were sitting still. Then he stopped short. The book on top was Being and Nothingness by Sartre. He still had the words written on the backs of his hands, a recommendation from Grandad. Gat bowed foolishly, clownishly, and presented me with a book at the bottom of the pile. It was a novel by Jacqueline Moriarty. I'd been reading her all summer. I opened the book to the title page. It was inscribed, "For Katie, with everything, everything, Gat." I remember waiting for your shoes so we could go into the clam shack, I tell Mirren. She has stopped talking now and looks at me expectantly. "Pinwheels," I say. Gat giving me a book.
"So your memories are coming back," Mirren says. "That's great."
"The aunties fought about the estate," she shrugs.
"A bit."
"And Grandad and I, we had this argument about his ivory statues."
"Yeah, we talked about it at the time."
"Tell me something."
"What?"
"Why did Gat disappear after my accident?" Mirren twists a strand of her hair.
"I don't know.
Did he go back with Raquel?"
"I don't know."
"Did we fight? Did I do something wrong?"
"I don't know, Katie."
"He got upset at me a few nights back about not knowing the names of the staff, about not having seen his apartment in New York." There is a silence.
"He has good reasons to be mad," says Mirren finally. "What did I do?"
Mirren sighs.
"You can't fix it."
"Why not?" Suddenly, Mirren starts choking, gagging like she might vomit, bending over at the waist, her skin damp and pale.
"You okay?"
"No."
"Can I help?"
She doesn't answer. I offer her a bottle of water. She takes it, drinks slowly.
"I did too much. I need to get back to Cuddle Down. Now."
Her eyes are glassy. I hold out my hand. Her skin feels wet, and she seems unsteady on her feet. We walk in silence to the harbor where the small motorboat is docked. Mummy never noticed the motorboat was missing, but she sees the bag of fudge when I give it to Taft and Will. On and on, natter, natter. Her lecture isn't interesting. I may not leave the island without permission from her. I may not leave the island without adult supervision. I may not operate a motor vehicle on medication. I can't be as stupid as I'm acting, can I? I say the sorry my mother wants to hear. Then I run down to Windermere and write everything I remembered. The clam shack, the pinwheel, Mirren's dirty feet on the wooden steps, the book Gat gave me, on the graph paper above my bed. Chapter 45. Start of my second week on Beechwood, we discover the roof of Cuddle Down. It's easy to climb up there. We just never did it before because it involves going through Aunt Bess's bedroom window. The roof is cold as hell in the nighttime, but in the day, there's a great view of the island and the sea beyond it. I can see over the trees that cluster around Cuddle Down to New Claremont and its garden. I can even see into the house, which has floor-to-ceiling windows and many of the ground-floor rooms. You can see a bit of Redgate, too, and the other direction, across to Windermere, then out to the bay. That first afternoon, we spread out food on an old picnic blanket. We eat Portuguese sweetbread and runny cheeses in small wooden boxes, berries in green cardboard, cold bottles of fizzy lemonade. We resolve to come here every day, all summer. This roof is the best place in the world. "If I die," I say as we look at the view. I mean, when I die. "Throw my ashes in the water of the tiny beach. Then when you miss me, you can climb up here, look down, and think how awesome I was."
"Or we could go down and swim in you," says Johnny, "if we missed you really badly."
"Ew!
You're the one who wanted to be in the water of the tiny beach."
"I just meant I love it here.
It'd be a grand place to have my ashes."
"Yeah," says Johnny.
"It would be."
Mirren and Gat have been silent, eating chocolate-covered hazelnuts out of a blue ceramic bowl.
"This is a bad conversation," Mirren says.
"It's okay," says Johnny. "I don't want my ashes here," says Gat.
"Why not?" I say.
We could all be together in the tiny beach.
And the littles will swim in us, yells Johnny.
You're grossing me out, snaps Mirren.
It's not actually that different from all the times I've peed in there, says Johnny.
Cack!
Oh, come on. Everyone pees in there.
I don't, says Mirren.
Yes, you do, he says. If the tiny beach water isn't made of pee now, after all these years of us peeing in it, a few ashes aren't going to ruin it.
Do you guys ever plan out your funeral? I ask.
What do you mean?
Johnny crinkles his nose. You know, in Tom Sawyer, when everyone thinks Tom and Huck and what's his name?
Joe Harper,
says Gat. Yeah, they think Tom, Huck, and Joe Harper are dead. The boys go to their own funeral and hear all the nice memories the townspeople have of them. After I read that, I always thought about my own funeral, like what kind of flowers and where I'd want my ashes, and the eulogy, too, saying how I was transcendentally awesome and won the Nobel Prize and the Olympics.
What did you win the Olympics for?
Asks Gat. Maybe handball.
Is there handball in the Olympics?
Yes.
Do you even play handball?
Not yet.
You better get started.
Most people plan their weddings, says Mirren. I used to plan my wedding.
Guys don't plan their weddings, says Johnny.
If I married Drake, I'd have all yellow flowers, Mirren says. Yellow flowers everywhere, and a spring yellow dress like a normal wedding dress, only yellow. And he would wear a yellow cummerbund.
He would have to love you very, very much to wear a yellow cummerbund, I tell her.
Yeah, says Mirren. But Drake would do it.
I'll tell you what I don't want at my funeral, says Johnny. I don't want a bunch of New York art world types who don't even know me standing around in a stupid-ass reception room. I don't want religious people talking about a god I don't believe in, says Gat.
Or a bunch of fake girls acting all sad and then putting lip gloss on in the bathroom and fixing their hair, says Mirren.
God, I quip. You make it sound like funerals aren't any fun.
Seriously, Katie, says Mirren, you should plan your wedding, not your funeral. Don't be morbid.
What if I never get married? What if I don't want to get married?
Plan your book party, then, or your art opening.
She's winning the Olympics and the Nobel Prize, says Gat. She can plan parties for those.
Okay, fine, I say. Let's plan my Olympic handball party, if it'll make you happy. So we do. Chocolate handballs wrapped in blue fondant, a gold dress for me, champagne flutes with tiny gold balls inside. We discuss whether people wear weird goggles for handball like they do for racquetball, and decide that for purposes of our party, they do. All the guests will wear gold handball goggles for the duration.
Do ye play on a handball team? Asks Gat. I mean, will there be a whole crew of Amazonian handball goddesses there celebrating victory with you? Or did you win it by your lonesome?
I have no idea.
You really have to start educating yourself about this, says Gat. Or you're never going to win the gold. We'll have to rethink the whole party if you only get the silver.
Life feels beautiful that day. The four of us liars. We have always been. We always will be. No matter what happens as we go to college, grow old, build lives for ourselves. No matter if Gad and I are together or not. No matter where we go, we will always be able to line up on the roof of Cuddledown and gaze at the sea. This island is ours. Here, in some way, We are young forever. Chapter 46. Days that follow are darker. Rarely do the liars want to go anywhere. Mirren has a sore throat and body aches. She stays mainly in Cuddledown. She paints pictures to hang in the hallways and makes rows of shelves along the edges of the countertops. Dishes pile in the sink and on the coffee table. DVDs and books are in messy stacks all over the great room. The beds lie unmade, and the bathrooms have a damp, mildewy smell. Johnny eats cheese with his fingers and watches British TV comedies. One day, he collects a row of old tea bags, soggy ones, and tosses them into a mug filled with orange juice. "What are you doing?" I ask.
"Biggest splash gets the most points."
"But why?"
"My mind works in mysterious ways," says Johnny.
"I find underhand is generally the best technique." I help him figure out a point system. 5 points for a sprinkle, 10 for a puddle, 20 for a decorative pattern on the wall behind the mug. We go through a whole bottle of fresh squeezed juice. When he's done, Johnny leaves the mug and the mangled, leaking tea bags where they lie. I don't clean up either. Gat has a list of the 100 greatest novels ever written, and he's pushing his way through whatever he's been able to find on the island. He marks them with sticky notes and reads passages aloud. Invisible Man, A Passage to India, The Magnificent Ambersons. I only half pay attention when he reads because Gat has not kissed me or reached out to me since we agreed to act normal. I think he avoids being alone with me. I avoid being alone with him, too, because my whole body sings to be near him, because every movement he makes is charged with electricity. I often think of putting my arms around him or running my fingers along his lips. When I let my thoughts go there, if for a moment Johnny and Mirren are out of sight, if for even a second we are alone, the sharp pain of unrequited love invites the migraine in. These days, she is a gnarled crone, touching the raw flesh of my brain with her cruel fingernails. She pokes my exposed nerves, exploring whether she'll take up residence in my skull. If she gets in, I'm confined to my bedroom for a day, or maybe two. We eat lunch on the roof most days. I suppose they do it when I'm ill, too. Every now and then a bottle rolls off the roof and the glass smashes. In fact, there are shards and shards of splintered glass sticky with lemonade all over the porch. Flies buzz around, attracted by the sugar. Chapter 47. End of the second week, I find Johnny alone in the yard, building a structure out of Lego pieces he must have found at Redgate. I've got pickles, cheese straws, and leftover grilled tuna from the new Claremont kitchen. We decide not to go on the roof since it's just the two of us. We open the containers and line them up on the edge of the dirty porch. Johnny talks about how he wants to build Hogwarts out of Lego, or a Death Star, or wait, even better is a Lego tuna fish to hang in New Claremont now that none of Granddad's taxidermy is there anymore. That's it. Too bad there's not enough Lego on this stupid island for a visionary project such as his. "Why didn't you call or email after my accident?" I ask. I hadn't planned to bring it up. The words spring out. "Oh, Katie." I feel stupid asking, but I want to know.
"You don't want to talk about Lego tuna fish instead?" Johnny vamps.
"I thought maybe you were annoyed with me about those emails, the ones I sent asking about Gat."
"No, no."
Johnny wipes his hands on his t-shirt.
"I disappeared because I'm an asshole, because I don't think through my choices, and I've seen too many action movies and I'm kind of a follower."
"Really? I don't think that about you."
It's an undeniable fact.
You weren't mad?
I was just a stupid fuck, but not mad. Never mad. I'm sorry, Cadence.
Thanks. He picks up a handful of Legos and starts fitting them together. Why did Gat disappear? Do you know? Johnny sighs.
That's another question.
He told me I don't know the real him.
Could be true.
He doesn't want to discuss my accident or what happened with us that summer. He wants us to act normal and like nothing happened.
Johnny's lined his Legos up in stripes, blue, white, and green.
Gat had been shitty to that girl, Raquel, by starting up with you. He knew it wasn't right, and he hated himself for that.
Okay.
He didn't want to be that kind of guy. He wants to be a good person. And he was really angry that summer about all kinds of things. When he wasn't there for you, he hated himself even more.
You think?
I'm guessing, says Johnny.
Is he going out with anyone?
Aw, Katie, says Johnny. He's a pretentious ass. I love him like a brother, but you're too good for him. Go find yourself a nice Vermont guy with muscles like Drake Loggerhead.
Then he cracks up laughing.
You're useless. I can't deny it,
he answers.
But you've got to stop being such a mushball.
Chapter 48 Giveaway Charmed Life by Diana Wynne Jones. It's one of the Crestomancy stories Mummy read to me and Gat the year we were 8. I've reread it several times since then, but I doubt Gat has. I open the book and write on the title page, For Gat, with everything, everything, Katie. I head to Cuddle Down early the next morning, stepping over old teacups and DVDs. I knock on Gat's bedroom door. No answer. I knock again, then push it open. It used to be Taft's room. It's full of bears and model boats. Plus Gat-like piles of books, empty bags of potato chips, cashews crushed underfoot, half-full bottles of juice and soda, CDs, the Scrabble box with most of its tiles spilled across the floor. It's as bad as the rest of the house, if not worse. Anyway, he's not there. He must be at the beach. I leave the book on his pillow. Chapter 49 That night, Gad and I find ourselves alone on the roof of Cuddledown. Mirren felt sick, and Johnny took her downstairs for some tea. Voices and music float from New Claremont, where the aunts and granddad are eating blueberry pie and drinking port. The littles are watching a movie in the living room. Gat walks the slant of the roof, all the way down to the gutter and up again. It seems dangerous, so easy to fall, but he is fearless. Now is when I can talk to him. Now is when we can stop pretending to be normal. I am looking for the right words, the best way to start. Suddenly, he climbs back to where I'm sitting in 3 big steps.
You are very, very beautiful, Katie, he says.
It's the moonlight. Makes all the girls look pretty.
I think you're beautiful, always and forever.
He is silhouetted against the moon.
Have you got a boyfriend in Vermont?
Of course I don't. I have never had a boyfriend except for him. My boyfriend is named Percocet, I say. We're very close. I even went to Europe with him last summer.
God!
Gad is annoyed, stands and walks back down to the edge of the roof.
Joking!
Gat's back is to me.
You say we shouldn't feel sorry for you.
Yes,
but then you come out with these statements. My boyfriend is named Percocet,
Or I stared at the base of the blue Italian toilet, and it's clear you want everyone to feel sorry for you. And we would. I would. But you have no idea how lucky you are.
My face flushes. He is right. I do want people to feel sorry for me. I do. And then I don't. I do. And then I don't. I'm sorry, I say.
Harris sent you to Europe for 8 weeks. You think he'll ever send Johnny or Mirren? No. And he wouldn't send me, no matter what. Just think before you complain about stuff other people would love to have.
I flinch. Granddad sent me to Europe?
Come on, says Gat bitter. Did you really think your father paid for that trip?
I know immediately that he is telling the truth. Of course Dad didn't pay for the trip. There's no way he could have. College professors don't fly first class and stay in five-star hotels. So used to summers on Beechwood, to endlessly stocked pantries and multiple motorboats, and a staff quietly grilling steaks and washing linens, I didn't even think about where that money might be coming from. Granddad sent me to Europe. Why? Why wouldn't Mummy go with me if the trip was a gift from Granddad? And why would Dad even take that money from my grandfather?
You have a life stretching out in front of you with a million possibilities, Gat says. It grates on me when you ask for sympathy. That's all.
Gat. My Gat. He is right. He is. But he also doesn't understand. I know no one's beating me, I say, feeling defensive all of a sudden. I know I have plenty of money and a good education, food on the table. I'm not dying of cancer. Lots of people have it much worse than I. And I do know I was lucky to go to Europe. I shouldn't complain about it or be ungrateful.
Okay, then.
But listen, you have no idea what it feels like to have headaches like this. No idea. It hurts, I say. And I realize tears are running down my face, though I'm not sobbing. It makes it hard to be alive some days. A lot of times, I wish I were dead. I truly do. Just to make the pain stop.
You do not, he says harshly. You do not wish you were dead. Don't say that.
I just want the pain to be over, I say. On the days the pills don't work. I want it to end, and I would do anything, really anything, if I knew for sure it would end the pain. There is a silence. He walks down to the bottom edge of the roof, facing away from me.
What do you do then, when it's like that?
Nothing. I lie there and wait, and remind myself over and over that it doesn't last forever. That there will be another day, and after that, yet another day. One of those days I'll get up and eat breakfast and feel okay.
Another day.
Yes.
Now he turns and bounds up the roof in a couple steps. Suddenly his arms are around me and we are clinging to each other.
He is shivering slightly and he kisses my neck with cold lips. We stay like that, enfolded in each other's arms for a minute or two. And it feels like the universe is reorganizing itself. And I know any anger we felt has disappeared. Gat kisses me on the lips and touches my cheek. I love him. I have always loved him. We stay up there on the roof for a very, very long time. Forever.
Chapter 50
Mirren has been getting ill more and more often. She gets up late, paints her nails, lies in the sun, and stares at pictures of African landscapes in a big coffee table book. But she won't snorkel, won't sail, won't play tennis or go to Edgartown. I bring her jelly beans from New Claremont. Mirren loves jelly beans. Today, she and I lie out on the tiny beach. We read magazines I stole from the twins and eat baby carrots. Mirren has headphones on. She keeps listening to the same song over and over on my iPhone. Our youth is wasted. We will not waste it. Remember my name, 'cause we made history. Na-na-na-na, na-na-na. I poke Mirren with a carrot.
What?
You have to stop singing, or I can't be responsible for my actions. Mirren turns to me, serious, pulls out the earbuds.
Can I tell you something, Katie?
Sure.
About you and Gat. I heard you two come downstairs last night.
So?
I think you should leave him alone.
What?
It's going to end badly and mess everything up.
I love him, I say. You know I've always loved him.
You're making things hard for him. Harder than they already are. You're going to hurt him.
That's not true. He'll probably hurt me.
Well, that could happen too. It's not a good idea for you guys to be together. Don't you see I would rather be hurt by Gat than be closed off from him?
I say, sitting up. I'd a million times rather live and risk and have it all end badly than stay in the box I've been in for the past 2 years. It's a tiny box, Mirren. Me and Mummy, me and my pills, me and my pain. I don't want to live there anymore. A silence hangs in the air.
I've never had a boyfriend, Mirren blurts.
I look into her eyes. There are tears. What about Drake Loggerwood? What about the yellow roses and the sexual intercourse? I ask. She looks down.
I lied.
Why?
You know how when you come to Beechwood, it's a different world. You don't have to be who you are back home. You can be somebody better, maybe.
I nod.
That first day you came back, I noticed Gat. He looked at you like you were the brightest planet in the galaxy.
He did?
I want someone to look at me that way so much, Katie. So much. And I didn't mean to, but I found myself lying. I'm sorry.
I don't know what to say. I take a deep breath. Mirren snaps.
Don't gasp, okay? It's fine. It's fine if I never have a boyfriend at all. It's fine if not one person ever loves me, all right? It's perfectly tolerable.
Mummy's voice calls from somewhere by New Claremont.
Cadence, can you hear me?
I yell back.
What do you want? The cook is off today. I'm starting lunch. Come slice tomatoes. In a minute.
I sigh and look at Mirren. I have to go. She doesn't answer. I pull my hoodie on and trudge up the path to New Claremont. In the kitchen, Mummy hands me a special tomato knife and starts to talk. Natter, natter, you're always on the tiny beach. Natter, natter, you should play with the littles. Granddad won't be here forever. Do you know you have a sunburn? I slice and slice. A basket full of strangely shaped heirloom tomatoes. They are yellow, green, and smoky red. Chapter 51. My third week on island is ticking by, and a migraine takes me out for 2 days, or maybe three. I can't even tell. The pills in my bottle are getting low, though I filled my prescription before we left home. I wonder if Mummy is taking them. Maybe she has always been taking them. Or maybe the twins have been coming in my room again, lifting things they don't need. Maybe they're users. Or maybe I am taking more than I know, popping extra in a haze of pain, forgetting my last dose. I am scared to tell Mummy I need more. When I feel stable, I come to cuddle down again. The sun hovers low in the sky. The porch is covered with broken bottles. Inside, the ribbons have fallen from the ceiling and lie twisted on the floor. The dishes in the sink are dry and encrusted. The quilts that cover the dining table are dirty. The coffee table is stained with circular marks from mugs of tea. I find the liars clustered in Mirren's bedroom, all looking at the Bible. "Scrabble word argument," says Mirren as soon as I enter. She closes the book. "Gat was right, as usual. You're always effing right, Gat. Girls don't like that in a guy, you know." The Scrabble tiles are scattered across the great room floor. I saw them when I walked in. They haven't been playing. "What did you guys do the past few days?" I ask.
"Oh, God," says Johnny, stretching out on Mirren's bed. "I forget already."
"It was 4th of July," says Mirren. "We went to supper at New Claremont, and then everyone went out in the big motorboat to see the vineyard fireworks."
"Today we went to the Nantucket donut shop," says Gat.
They never go anywhere. Ever. Never see anyone. Now while I've been sick, they went everywhere? Saw everyone?
"Downy Flake," I say. "That's the name of the donut shop."
"Yeah, they were the most amazing donuts," says Johnny.
"You hate cake donuts."
"Of course," says Mirren, "but we didn't get the cake. We got glazed twists."
"And Boston cream," says Gat. "And jelly," says Johnny.
But I know Downy Flake only makes cake donuts. No glazed, no Boston cream, no jelly. Why are they lying?
Chapter 52. I eat supper with Mummy and the Littles at New Claremont, but that night I'm hit with a migraine again. It's worse than the one before. I lie in my darkened room. Scavenger birds peck at the oozing matter that leaks from my crushed skull. I open my eyes, and Gat stands over me. I see him through a haze. Light shines through the curtains, so it must be day. Gat never comes to Windermere, but here he is, looking at the graph paper on my wall, at the sticky notes, at the new memories and information I've added since I've been here, notes about Gran's dogs dying, Grandad and the ivory goose, Gat giving me the Moriarty book, the ants fighting about the Boston house.
"Don't read my papers," I moan. "Don't."
He steps back.
"It's up there for anyone to see. Sorry."
I turn on my side to press my cheek against the hot pillow.
"I didn't know you were collecting stories."
Gat sits on the bed, reaches out and takes my hand.
"I'm trying to remember what happened that nobody wants to talk about," I say. "Including you." "I want to talk about it."
"You do?" He is staring at the floor.
"I had a girlfriend 2 summers ago."
"I know. I knew all along."
"But I never told you."
"No, you didn't."
"I fell for you so hard, Katie. There was no stopping it. I know I should have told you everything, and I should have broken it off with Raquel right away. It was just, she was back home, and I never see you all year, and my phone didn't work here, and I kept getting packages from her and letters all summer."
I look at him.
"I was a coward," Gat says.
"Yeah."
"It was cruel, to you and to her, too."
My face burns with remembered jealousy.
"I am sorry, Katie,"
Gat goes on.
That's what I should have said to you the first day we got here this year. I was wrong, and I'm sorry.
I nod. It is nice to hear him say that. I wish I weren't so high.
Half the time I hate myself for all the things I've done, says Gat. But the thing that makes me really messed up is the contradiction. When I'm not hating myself, I feel righteous and victimized, like the world is so unfair.
Why do you hate yourself? And before I know it, Gat is lying on the bed next to me. His cold fingers wrap around my hot ones, and his face is close to mine. He kisses me.
Because I want things I can't have, he whispers.
But he has me. Doesn't he know he already has me? Or is Gat talking about something else? Something else he can't have. Some material thing. Some dream of something. I am sweaty, and my head hurts, and I can't think clearly. Mirren says it'll end badly, and I should leave you alone, I tell him. He kisses me again. Someone did something to me that is too awful to remember, I whisper.
I love you, he says.
We hold each other and kiss for a long time. The pain in my head fades a little, but not all the way. I open my eyes and the clock reads midnight. Gat is gone. I pull the shades and look out the window, lifting the sash to get some air. Aunt Carrie is walking in her nightgown again, passing by Windermere, scratching her two thin arms in the moonlight. She doesn't even have her shearling boots on this time. Over at Redgate, I can hear Will crying from a nightmare.
Mommy! Mommy, I need you!
But Carrie either doesn't hear him or else she will not go. She veers away and heads up the path toward New Claremont. Chapter 53 Giveaway. A plastic box of Legos. I've given away all my books now. I gave a few to the Littles, one to Gat, and went with Aunt Bess to donate the rest to a charity shop on the vineyard. This morning I rummaged through the attic. There's a box of Legos there, so I bring them to Johnny. I find him alone in the cuddle-down great room, hurling bits of Play-Doh at the wall and watching the colors stain the white paint. He sees the Legos and shakes his head.
For your tuna fish, I explain. Now you'll have enough.
I'm not going to build it, he says.
Why not?
Too much work, he says. Give them to Will.
Don't you have Will's Legos down here?
I brought them back. Little guy was starved for them, Johnny says. He'll be happy to have more.
I bring them to Will at lunch. There are little Lego people and lots of parts for building cars. He is ridiculously happy. He and Taft build cars all through the meal. They don't even eat. Chapter 54 That same afternoon, the Liars get the kayaks out.
What are you doing? I ask.
Going round the point to this place we know, says Johnny. We've done it before.
Katie shouldn't come, says Mirren.
Why not? Asks Johnny.
Because of her head, shouts Mirren. What if she hurts her head again and her migraines get even worse? God! Do you even have a brain, Johnny?
Why are you yelling? Yells Johnny. Don't be so bossy.
Why don't they want me to come?
You can come, Cadence, says Gat. It's fine if she comes.
I don't want to tag along when I'm not wanted. But Gat pats the kayak seat in front of him and I climb in. I do not really want to be separate from them. Ever. We paddle the two-person kayaks around the bayside under Windermere to an inlet. Mummy's house sits on an overhang.
Beneath it is a cluster of craggy rocks that almost feels like a cave. We pull the kayaks onto the rocks and climb to where it's dry and cool. Mirren is seasick, though we were only in the kayaks for a few minutes. She is sick so often now, it's no surprise. She lies down with her arms over her face. I half expect the boys to unpack a picnic. They have a canvas bag with them. But instead, Gad and Johnny begin climbing the rocks. They've done it before, I can tell. They're barefoot, and they climb to a high point 25 feet above the water, stopping on a ledge that hangs over the sea. I watch them until they are settled.
What are you doing?
We are being very, very manly, Johnny calls back. His voice echoes. Gat laughs.
No, really, I say.
You might think we are city boys, but truth is, we are full of masculinity and testosterone.
Are not.
Are too.
Oh, please. I'm coming up with you.
No, don't, says Mirren. Johnny baited me, I say. Now I have to. I begin climbing in the same direction the boys went. The rocks are cold under my hands, slicker than I expected.
Don't, Mirren repeats. This is why I didn't want you to come.
Why did you come, then? I ask. Are you going up there?
I jumped last time, Mirren admits. Once was enough.
They're jumping? It doesn't even look possible.
Stop, Katie. It's dangerous, says Gat.
And before I can climb farther, Johnny holds his nose and jumps. He plummets feet first from the high rock. I scream. He hits the water with force, and the sea is filled with rocks here. There's no telling how deep or shallow it is. He could seriously die doing this. He could. But he pops up, shaking the water off his short yellow hair and whooping.
You're crazy, I scold.
Then Gat jumps. Whereas Johnny kicked and hollered as he went down, Gat is silent, legs together. He slices into the icy water with hardly a splash. He comes up happy, squeezing water out of his t-shirt as he climbs back onto the dry rocks.
They're idiots, says Mirren.
I look up at the rocks from which they jumped. It seems impossible anyone could survive. And suddenly, I want to do it. I start climbing again.
Don't, Katie, says Gat. Please don't.
You just did, I say, and you said it was fine if I came.
Mirren sits up, her face pale.
I want to go home now, she says urgently. I don't feel well.
Please don't, Katie. It's rocky, calls Johnny. We shouldn't have brought you.
I'm not an invalid, I say. I know how to swim.
That's not it. It's not a good idea.
Why is it a good idea for you and not a good idea for me? I snap.
I am nearly at the top. My fingertips are already beginning to blister with clutching the rock. Adrenaline shoots through my bloodstream.
We were being stupid, says Gat.
Showing off, says Johnny. Come down, please.
Mirren is crying now. I do not come down. I am sitting, knees to my chest, on the ledge from which the boys jumped. I look at the sea churning beneath me. Dark shapes lurk beneath the surface of the water. But I can also see an open space. If I position my jump right, I will hit deep water.
Always do what you are afraid to do, I call out.
That's a stupid-ass motto, says Mirren. I told you that before.
I will prove myself strong when they think I am sick. I will prove myself brave when they think I am weak. It's windy on this high rock. Mirren is sobbing. Gat and Johnny are shouting at me. I close my eyes and jump. The shock of the water is electric, thrilling. My leg scrapes a rock, my left leg. I plunge down. Down to rocky, rocky bottom, and I can see the base of Beechwood Island and my arms and legs.